everybody. This is Mark Longhurst, the editor of the Alumni Quarterly. This interview is with Darlene Ortega. Darlene is a recent Living School grad from 2019. She is a judge on the Oregon Court of Appeals, and she has a special interest in working with marginalized groups from a race, equity, and belonging perspective. In this conversation, I ask her about a powerful ritual called Centering the Margins that she helped the Living School team create at the most recent symposium. I encourage you to listen in to hear us talk about that, about contemplative solidarity, about how the Living School is evolving, and more. And as always, I welcome your questions and feedback at mlonghurst@cac.org, and I'm wishing you grace and peace on this day. So, hey, Darlene, thank you for taking some time to speak with me and to the Living School alumni community. We're grateful to be hearing from you today.
Thanks.
First, I want to ask a little bit about who you are and how you first discovered the Center for Action and Contemplation.
I am a judge on the Oregon Court of Appeals. I've been a Quaker and a contemplative my whole adult life. And have kind of a long-standing experience with contemplative practice. About, I want to say maybe 7 years ago, I heard Richard speak in Portland, where I'm from. And he had just, I think it was about 7 years ago, Falling Upward had just come out. And I and my partner, who was a pastor, were very struck by what Richard shared, and we read Falling Upward together. And then shortly after that, my partner passed away real tragically. And so it was a very, very tragic circumstances for me. And I ended up sort of consuming, like, I can't claim to have read everything Richard's written, but probably everything that's he's written in the last at least 10 to 15 years. Mm-hmm. And the books were really, really helpful to me. And I was receiving the daily meditations, and in my world as a judge, I deal with quite a bit of pushback because of how I approach that work. And Richard's writing was really helpful to me for that. So it was kind of in the context of that that I connected with the CAC.
Mm-hmm. And what brought you to the Living School?
I mean, kind of that part of that same journey. Mm-hmm. I am working in a system that's not unique, but maybe particularly difficult in terms of all the things that make systems really problematic. Richard talks about it in terms of being too big to fail. And my calling also has involved a lot of work addressing racism. These are all things that don't make me popular within that system, because I'm asking questions that are not meant to be asked. And I don't generally have allies who are, you know, in the same location in the system. I mean, I have people that I'm mentoring and stuff that are very supportive, but they don't have any power. Mm-hmm. So it's been I've been on kind of a quest regularly to find people that can support me and, be in, you know, solidarity with the journey that I'm on, and that's what attracted me to the Living School.
Mm-hmm. At the recent symposium in August, you had a leadership role in creating a ritual called Centering the Margins, and mm-hmm. this was the first time such a ritual had happened in the Living School. For alumni that didn't have a chance to experience that, what was it, and mm-hmm. and what was your role in helping create that?
Well, so what the ritual was, we created it as a ritual meant to be like, this is not like a performance, this is not, we're not doing something theoretical here. We're really meaning this to be a practice that we are all doing together, that we approach like we would approach other spiritual practices like centering prayer or the welcoming prayer or various other things that we do, that are meant to help us experience temporarily a break from our default ways of reacting to being human. Because we can't, as I think those of us who are on this journey learn to some degree or other, the cognitive route doesn't get us all the way there, because we're living, we're in our bodies and we're reacting to things out of pattern, out of ego, out of our dualistic thought patterns, out of trauma, all of these things. So we meant to set it up as a practice to help us get out of our default ways of being with regard to marginalized voices. A practice like this could be used to center other marginalized voices besides people of color, but we decided to focus this particular practice around marginalized voices who are people of color. And the reason for that is that what happens accidentally without any conscious intention being implied, in fact, sometimes even with conscious intention being implied, is that the white voices are centered. White voices set the agenda. White voices have an easier time being heard. And what the experience of people of color generally is, if we're brought in at all, we're in the minority and we're trying to fit into a context that isn't built for us and we don't experience it as really inviting what we have to say. Even if that's not happening on a conscious level, you just kind of learn, you're socialized to know, like, don't say a whole bunch of things that are part of your experience. Mm-hmm. So the practice arose out of a recognition that no matter what, how great our intentions are, that does not change without some kind of conscious intention being applied. Just like getting out of our dualistic thinking doesn't change because we want it to. We have to like practice that. So we set up a circumstance and it was a period over months and it arose out of quite a bit of group process between me and people on the staff that were planning the symposium. So it wasn't like I handed them this thing. In the course of our planning for the symposium, this idea came up. When it first came up, I brought it up, and I brought it up like, I am not suggesting we do this, but here's what's rising for me, kind of a thing, like, but in the course of it, there's a lot of contemplative practice around doing this. I did propose basically the outline of what we did, and then as a group, we kind of worked it out. But I kind of coordinated the building of it. Mm-hmm. And we set it up so that we had, we used the something the Smithsonian uses called the long conversation as a bit of a beginning point. And the long conversation, the way they do it, is they'll have a speaker and a questioner addressing the same question serially. And I think they do it in like maybe 10-minute blocks or something. So they'll have two people up there, and one of them is asking the question and then kind of fleshing out what the answerer is saying for about 10 minutes. And then the speaker goes off and the questioner becomes the speaker and a new questioner comes on. And it's a way of kind of seeing the variety of perspectives on a particular topic. So we started with that and actually expanded it into a sort of a Trinitarian container, springing from a recognition that as Richard develops pretty well, and also Cynthia and other writers that some of us have read, there's something about the law of three that that can hold things differently, hold that energy differently. So we set it up so that the speaker and questioner roles in the way we did the ritual were only fulfilled by people of color. But there was a third role that we called the witness, who was a white participant. And the role of the white participant was not to just sit there and shut up at all. It was a very active role, in many ways, sort of like analogous to the role of spirit, to hold space for what was happening. And then we had a question, or kind of a category of questions, that we wanted the speakers to address for, they had 7 minutes. So we're doing this at the Living School. I think we had a total of an hour and a half time slot. The beginning of it, I and Kirsten Oates sort of explained the framing of what we were doing. And then we had 8 participants of color rotate through the roles of questioner and speaker. And then we had 8 white participants perform that role of witness. Mm-hmm. And the questions that we asked the speakers to address really had to do with, as they do their contemplative work of working to become more deeply connected to what's true, to live in a more embodied way, you know, the work of living school students, what has risen for them in terms of their experience as people of color. And we explicitly wanted to recognize, like, they're, what these speakers are doing, we have not earned the trust for this. And it's likely to be very challenging for them because, speaking from personal experience, and this resonated for the people of color who participated, we don't have any experience doing this, actually being invited to speak about that aspect of our experience and having that be held. That's like, that just like basically never happens in a predominantly white space like that. So we named in the beginning, like, we have not, this community has not earned the trust that it takes to do this. So this is a spiritual practice for all of us. And it requires, it requires spiritual work on behalf of everybody. Not just, this is not something the people of color are doing to the white participants or something. It requires something of all of us. We're all kind of altering what happens accidentally in a very intentional way. And in order, among other things, to help us begin to just barely begin to taste what we're missing in our interactions with each other, mm-hmm. in our default ways of being, which are systemic, that no one of us created, but we all kind of swim in. This does not happen. And we are losing a lot in the quality of our interactions with each other, in our ability to be in solidarity with each other, in our ability to hear each other, in our ability to have complete and nourishing conversations that include everyone's experience. We are all very hindered from doing that in the existing construct. And we're not going to fix that in this practice. Mm-hmm. Just like no, you know, 20-minute sit fixes our thinking. But it as we practice doing that, it opens up a hunger, it opens up some connection to what's possible that we don't even know to hunger for. And that was the aim of the practice. And for some, I don't even assume it's everyone, but for some, I think it had that effect of sort of awakening us to things we just had no idea were possible. Mm-hmm. And no idea that we were missing in our interactions with each other.
I find that so powerful to think about centering the margins ritualistically as contemplative practice that is right upside, right alongside our centering prayer practice, right alongside our Lectio Divina. Mm-hmm. I know this is a huge question, but why is it that we tend to think of some things as contemplative practices, but not centering margins as a contemplative mm-hmm. practice?
Wow. I almost want to like turn that question right back on everybody listening. Because I think that's I often say curiosity is a spiritual practice. And in fact, the curiosity that is cultivated can be a real superpower. It opens up all kinds of possibilities. And the question you just asked, I can give some my thoughts about it, but I wouldn't want any of my thoughts to close down the question because I think it's really an essential one. We don't, in normal life, and this is definitely true in the U.S., but it's not only true in the U.S., we don't even tend to act like margins exist. We're very attached to the idea that, you know, the American dream, you know, everybody has a shot and, mm-hmm. and it's like a meritocracy that we're functioning mm-hmm. in and that both gains and losses are earned. And so even the very idea that there would be margins to center, mm-hmm. I think is challenging in a very spiritual way. the very topic is threatening to people, which may be a tell, right? Things that are that threatening, like, why am I feeling so threatened? That's often a sign that our dualistic thinking is involved, or our clouded perceptions are hindering us. Mm-hmm. So I think, I guess part of why I tumbled to this suggestion and felt very led to pursue it is because I know that, to use racism as an example, and it's only an example, but a very powerful one, racism exists in structures. I mean, racism certainly includes, like, oh, I hate black people, like people who would believe that and say that, that's racist. But that's the tip of the iceberg of racism. Racism, I know, exists in structures, and so it involves all of us. I like to use the Matrix a lot. I think the film Matrix, for those who have seen it, is like the perfect metaphor for this. The machine is telling us things and we're believing them. Mm-hmm. And until we engage in the practice of pulling, or allowing ourselves to be pulled out of the matrix so that we can free our mind, we end up being stuck inside and enlisted to maintain a systems of interacting with each other that are not true and that harm all of us. And that does not begin to be altered without some practice around that specific thing.
This kind of goes along with what you've just been saying, but why might it be important for a white person to be a witness and to center a person of color voice? You've described the system that creates that need, but I just want to draw it out of you a little more.
I'm glad you asked that. What happens accidentally, even with the best of intentions on the part of white people, is that their voices and experiences will be centered. And that's not even, it's not like because all white people are so selfish or something like that. That's what serves the existing systems of oppression. That's what serves them. So, and it also harms white people. It doesn't only harm people of color, it harms white people. It's not true. it keeps us from seeing what's true. It facilitates harm that we can't see ourselves doing, and we think something else is happening. It's just illusion, like so many things that we need to disconnect from. And so for a white participant in the ritual, as we set it up, it felt important to alter that dynamic of what accidentally happens in terms of whose voice and whose perspective is centered. And we know that silence is powerful. And we know that when we say silence, we don't necessarily, in this case, we definitely did not mean just shut up. We meant holding space. We meant, and Kirsten described this really well in the introduction, and was the first white participant. Like, this is powerful work to listen with that quality of intention. And it required the white participants to, things would come up for them, like, why am I not talking? Or I want to say this, or this makes me feel guilty, or I want to fix this, or I want to disagree with what this person is telling about their experience. And to go to the work of just holding that, just hold that. That is powerful spiritual work, and it's powerful practice. And I think a lot of times why our experience or our interactions default to something other than that is because what rises is so often full of anxiety. And then we default to what the culture tells us we can do with that anxiety. And that kind of obliterates often the kind of interaction that would be possible if we were really in community with each other. And in the end, that harms all of us. It actually harms all of us. And so we're caught, you know, we're just caught inside the matrix, inside this like way of viewing things that's not true, and we can't see our way around it. And it's just like water is to a fish. It's just not perceptible. But I think that practice had the capacity to unlock the white participants, including those in the in the audience. Mm-hmm. And we did name them in the beginning. It's like, you're not here as a spectator. Mm-hmm. This practice involves those of you in the audience as well. And here's how we would encourage you to participate in that practice.
Yeah.
So, you know, it required some similar things of everybody in the room who was white, I think.
Yeah. I'm reflecting on my experience being a witness from the audience, and that teaching of Cynthia Bourgeau's about the power of centering prayer to help put our mind in the heart. Mm-hmm. I almost feel that we experienced a collective mind and heart as mm-hmm. white people holding the voices of POC people. Mm-hmm. I didn't get a chance to debrief enough to hear if that was other people's experience, but it was my experience. Mm-hmm. So this edition of the Living School Quarterly is built around the theme of rhythm of life. And there is a new edition of the rhythm of life, which the CAC is Living School staff are naming contemplative solidarity. Mm-hmm. That's a change from contemplative service. And why might contemplative solidarity be important to you? And how is this an example of contemplative solidarity?
This being the centering the margins ritual?
Yeah, or is it an example of contemplative solidarity?
Yeah. So I've been involved in that aspect of the movement of the curriculum too, and it's still moving. Because I think we want to put some more legs around what that means for people. But for now, what I'll say is this. Contemplative service is really important. But in the context of human interaction now, the danger of service often is that a more privileged person or a person with more kind of social capital goes in and does some act of help that may or may not be very helpful because it's not informed by the perspective of the person being helped. And I am anywhere close to the first person to make that connection. That's really pretty well documented in from a lot of voices. Particularly voices working on how to actually uplift oppressed communities. Mm-hmm. So there's a real danger inside the Living School. If, you know, those of us who are, and I include myself in this, those of us who are students in the Living School were necessarily a pretty privileged bunch or we wouldn't be there. Mm-hmm. And usually when we think of service, we're like trying to think of somebody less privileged that we're gonna help. If we haven't done the work of building meaningful connections with the communities that we're trying to help, we might or might not be very helpful. And as importantly, or maybe more so, we haven't done our own work because from a contemplative standpoint, acts of service should involve examination of our own location and a deeper engagement with what's true. And so to leave that piece out would be a real shortcut. And it's a real danger for any of us who are operating from a position of relative privilege, because we will take those shortcuts without knowing we're doing it. We just don't know. We don't have the information. Mm-hmm. So the idea of contemplative solidarity is really moving away from, okay, now at your last 6 months of the Living School, find a service project and do it, because that doesn't actually allow enough time to do the amount of spiritual work that would really reflect even the ability to tell how to be helpful. So solidarity involves really doing some contemplative practice around how we exist in relation to other human beings. From where I operate, I'll apply this to myself as an example. I am a judge. So I am, my job, my work in the world involves administering the legal system. Well, the way that job is constructed, no judge is remotely inquired or required to engage with members of the communities that are most impacted by the negative aspects of the judicial process. We don't have to at all. Mm-hmm. And even if we're people of color, as I am, mm-hmm. You know, we're in a position of relative privilege. And so we don't even experience the legal system in the way most other people of color do. And if you go to a legal event, we're sort of applaud every legal event. They introduce the judges and we get applauded. Like, it's amazing that we're judges. and so there's like no pressure on us to do anything other than stay in our little world, mm-hmm. think great thoughts, answer big questions, entirely uninformed by those who are most painfully affected by our work. Mm-hmm. So for me, the work of contemplative solidarity has involved, again, altering what accidentally happened, exposing myself to the perspectives of people who are affected by the system that I'm involved in administering in a listening capacity. Mm-hmm. So I'm not going there and raising money for legal services. I mean, I do, you know, contribute to that, but that's not contemplative solidarity, that's mm-hmm. service. Mm-hmm. It's a matter of like putting myself in a position to listen to currently or formerly incarcerated people, or listening to immigrants, or listening to refugees, or listening to children who spent time in foster care, or listening to parents whose children have spent time in foster care, and listening with curiosity and trying to understand what that experience has to teach me. Now, what that kind of practice, I can say from personal experience, tends to do is awaken a lot of discomfort and a lot of anxiety. And the impulse will be like to excuse it or to be like, well, that's really terrible. They had that experience, but they should understand that the system's really fair and we do our best and, you know, all that. So I have to be like the white participants in the Centering the Margins ritual. I have to be prepared to just hold all that and listen anyway with curiosity. And I mean, I think spirit's resourceful and it must be possible to do this without the spiritual groundedness, but it would be a lot harder. I think mm-hmm. it would be a lot harder to hold that anxiety and to build that capacity for discomfort. And then what I have found and what I often tell people is the chances that you will learn what kind of offering is yours to make is much better after 50 occasions of listening to somebody's story and just feeling like, I don't know what to do about that. That's really terrible. Mm-hmm. I feel guilty about that. Mm-hmm. That makes me feel awful. After 50 occasions of that, you might on the 51st occasion see something that you could do that you never would have seen without mm-hmm. those 50 occasions, because you wouldn't have listened long enough. You mm-hmm. would have gone right to what you needed to do to quell your own anxiety, which is not a very helpful gauge for what would be helpful to the person that you're trying to help. Yeah. So that contemplative process of listening to where you sit in a structure affects other people with less privilege than you, and holding the information, holding your own anxiety, fear, guilt, whatever, from a place of listening is what can get you to the capacity to be in solidarity. Mm-hmm. So the process is all around, what questions should I be asking myself? Who might I build relationships of trust that I am building by listening, so that I can alter what accidentally happens with the hope of beginning to see how I might be called to stand up for what's true, probably at cost. When I do that, it costs me pretty mm-hmm. much always. Mm-hmm. I do not, as I often also say, systems do not reward you for transforming them. Mm-hmm. Pretty much ever. They're constructed for that never to happen. So you're stepping outside how the system is constructed to work. Byard Rustin, who was a collaborator with Martin Luther King, talked about it as he used the metaphor of putting your body in the gears of the machine. Wow. You know, when the gears of the machine roll over your body, it hurts. So you build the capacity to do that. Yeah. And your body then makes it more obvious that the machine is operating wrong. You know, the sacrifices that you make are what brings that truth to life. That's a long journey. You never do that in 6 months. that's like putting yourself on a different path. So that's how we're thinking about contemplative solidarity.
That is very powerful. And one of my questions was, what difference does contemplation make to this work of diversity, equity, inclusion, solidarity? Mm-hmm. And I think you've just so beautifully knit both of them together so that they're inseparable in your response. Mm-hmm. So really, thank you for that. And I know that this is going to be very helpful and educational for our alumni as we continue to evolve with the evolution of the Living School itself. So we're very grateful, Darlene. Thank you.